All right. Good morning, everybody. Monday morning, October 25th, 11:15. We're doing Chem 12B. And I was trying to think where we left off. I was looking back at my notes and thinking about last week and where we left things off at. And we were talking about the sharpless epoxidation. And I promised that I would come back and give you some idea as to how that sharpless epoxidation works, because it's really kind of cool. I don't want to spend too much time on the sharpless epoxidation because while we use it, explaining it is complicated, and it's not really something that we dive into a great deal. But just to give you an understanding of where that sharpless epoxidation comes from and why it's asymmetric. So let me back up a little bit. Let me go ahead and start the notes and start showing you sort of where we left off with, and then we'll try to explain this a little bit, then we'll move on and we'll jump into some other things. So let me start the screen share. And make sure I'm in the right spot. Okay. So what we were doing last time was showing this sharpless epoxidation. And what we said is that we can take an alkene, as long as the alkene has a certain structure to it, that alcohol is critical. We could use tertiary butyl peroxide and titanium tetraisopropoxide. So this is OIPR4. And then we use this catalyst that is either plus or minus DEET. And we show that we could go ahead and we could make an epoxide, stereoselectively. And actually what I'm gonna do is I'm gonna put those as straight bonds rather than wedge bonds, and then I'll do that guy. And so this is not plus minus. This is enantio specific. And we said that DEET, the structure for DEET, and if we use minus DEET, we get the opposite enantiomer. So DEET is from tartaric acid. Tartaric acid is a byproduct of winemaking, and it can be obtained enantiomerically pure in that process from winemaking or from grapes as a natural product. So this is plus tartaric acid, I believe. I hope that's right. I'm hoping the plus part is right. I know it's tartaric acid. And what they do is they esterify it. So they use ethyl alcohol and a little bit of acid and some heat. Or actually, what's the other way to do this? This could be done with a Dean Stark trap, PTSA and Dean Stark trap. And they esterify this. Making the ester. And that is where they get the plus DEET. So it's diethyl tartrate. So it's a chiral catalyst that is made out of a diol and a diester. And what this does is that titanium isopropoxide, when we look at titanium isopropoxide, is a titanium that has four ligands on it. And each one of these isopropoxides bind to the titanium in a square planar arrangement. When you take and you add DEET to this, it breaks up this complex and it makes a new complex. So titanium isopropoxide plus this tertiary butyl peroxide plus the DEET forms a dimer. And so I'm going to try to reproduce that dimer complex and show you what this thing looks like. This is the hard part to draw and showing what really happens with this. So when you look at what's going on here, each one of these oxygens is binding to the titanium and giving the titanium electrons to offset the titanium's positive charge to try to get it up to 18 electrons. These oxygen lone pairs that are utilized to do this are going to be replaced by these guys, or some of these guys, and one of these guys. And they wind up forming this complex. And because of the chirality of this molecule, it forms a very specific complex. So let's see if I can draw this accurately. We get titanium that forms a a bridge network here and then this goes back to a five-membered ring system. And this is another oxygen that comes in and forms there, and off of this guy is the ester. And that is binding to the titanium on the top. On the bottom is another isopropoxide that is sitting on the bottom. And then out on this side is another isopropoxide. On the other, what I've got is a similar sort of five-membered ring system that comes out in the front. And on this is the carbonyl that binds to the titanium. And on the bottom is another isopropoxide. And then going out back here is another one. And I think that gets almost everybody except for right here, which is an OH. And going down, which is an OH. So those DEETs, when I look at this guy, with these ester groups and the oxygens and the carbonyls, and I think I've got it wrong that it's not just an OH here, it's the ester component that comes off of this. So that's not an OH, this is actually going to be the ester. Now I see why they abbreviate it, because they abbreviate it in the thing that I'm looking at to do it, but this is also the ester that is here. Those deep components, that chiral ligand is sitting there, and it's sitting there. So those are the two chiral ligands. And what winds up happening now, when you bring in the when you bring in the alcohol with the double bond on it, so we bring in these two pieces. And as we bring those two pieces in, they displace a couple of the other ligands. So let me take this guy, and I don't expect you to keep up with this in the notes. That's okay. All I want to do is show you where this comes from. And I'm going to get rid of that little bit of color that's there, and I'm going to get rid of this one. And this one. There's the tertiary butoxide. So there's that piece. The other piece comes in and binds to the top right here and comes down and is the double bond that sits there with the R group. And the oxygen that transfers is that oxygen. So the transfer of the oxygen is happening right here. But that transfer of oxygen can only happen on one face because of the way that this thing is bound in place. And because of this group on the other side doesn't allow for this thing to turn around and for this oxygen to come from the other side, it creates a pocket in this molecule that when this oxygen binds, this double bond can only face one direction. And the R group here, whatever R group is going on, restricts the rotation of this thing. And the oxygen can only be delivered from one face. It cannot be delivered from the other face. This is inherently how most enantioselective reactions are done. They use a chiral auxiliary, that's what we call it, that is stereospecific, that creates a pocket that is bound by the other two organic molecules where it can only transfer from one face.
This is not catalytic, right?
It is catalytic, absolutely. Because what's happening is, this is the catalyst and it's used in a small mole percent. These two are binding to it, doing their job, letting go, and two new ones come in. And so as soon as this oxygen transfers, it opens up a binding spot on the titanium. And then this guy leaves as an alcohol and a new one comes in and takes its place. And it does, it is catalytic. Absolutely. And that's what's really, really pretty about it. So the model, the way that we do the model is we look at it this way. We take the allylic alcohol and we draw the allylic alcohol in a very specific orientation that puts the hydroxyl group there. And then these R groups, whatever these R groups are, we orient this and we think about this as a plane where this is the top and this is the bottom. And then plusdeet will cause the transfer of the oxygen from the top. And minusdeet will cause the transfer of the oxygen from the bottom. And so what we wind up having is that when we look at plusdeet in this reaction and how it goes forward, we wind up with an epoxide where we get that epoxide from the top. And if it's from the bottom and it's minusdeet, we get transfer from the bottom. And you get those enantio specifically. And so that's the model, is we just take and we orient the hydroxyl group in the front on the right. And if it's plus D, oxygen comes from the top. If it's minus D, oxygen comes from the bottom. That's the whole model. And that's what we do. So we don't go back and try to analyze this or draw this or figure out how all that works. What I needed to do was I needed to show you why it works the way it does. Because most of the time when we do a chemical reaction, we say we always get enantiomers. This reaction, we don't get enantiomers. And the reason that we don't get enantiomers is because it's done with a chiral auxiliary. And so it is this piece right here that we call a chiral auxiliary. And it directs the epoxidation in a particular orientation. And that's the beauty of that reaction. So we can use that to enantioselectively put an epoxide in any particular place we want. The key is that the molecule has to have this allylic alcohol, because that alcohol is what is binding at the top of the titanium right there. And without that, there's no way to hold the double bond. So it needs to have that oxygen. It needs to have that allylic alcohol nature to it in order for this whole thing to work. And without that hydroxyl group there, the reaction doesn't work. All right, so that's the gist of that whole thing. The other part of this is just looking at understanding what we can do with epoxides. So these are epoxides as electrophiles. So when I'm looking at epoxides as electrophiles, what I'm looking at is some nucleophile coming in with a negative charge and opening this up and making a new bond with that nucleophile. And then in the second step, we acidify it to produce the alcohol. So this is that pattern that we've been discussing. We've discussed it a number of times. It's that 1-2 pattern where I can look at the nucleophile on carbon number one and the hydroxyl group on carbon number two. So that's the general sort of idea there. What we do with that is to make it even more general. We can look at making the epoxide and then reacting this with a nucleophile. And number two, dilute acid. And that nucleophile, because this is an SN2 reaction, is always going to target that least substituted side. And that's going to always do that 1-2 pattern. So when we look at the centers here, we've got a primary center, we've got a secondary center, and because it's an SN2 reaction, it's always going to go for that primary center as opposed to the secondary center. So the numbering is different than looking at the substitution pattern, right? So that we understand primary, secondary, tertiary versus a numbering where I'm just numbering to show the 1-2 pattern where the nucleophile attacks on 1, epoxide opens up and the hydroxyl is still attached to 2. So that's the numbering system. But the choice of the two sides and why the nucleophile attacks one side versus the other has to do with primary versus secondary and the fact that this is an SN2 reaction. Maybe I'll change that to blue to reflect that it's primary versus secondary, that the choice is being made here in how that attacks. So if we were to take an example and show an example of something like this and how we might use this, we could take an epoxide that might be a single isomer, and we can react this with sodium cyanide. And 2, we can use dilute acid. And we can ask what the outcome is. The nucleophile, in this case, is cyanide. So structurally, that cyanide has the negative charge on the carbon. So it's a carbon nucleophile. We go and we look at the epoxide and we assess the epoxide to see what the centers look like on the epoxide. So this looks like it's a secondary center. That's a tertiary center. So we will prefer to attack at the secondary center, opening it up there, breaking that bond, pushing the electrons that way. So we'll get, on the first step, we'll get that intermediate where it opens up and becomes the O minus. We did an SN2 reaction. So the cyano group is attached there. That would be the first step, but then the dilute acid, the protonation, would protonate that to become the alcohol. And so we would expect to get OH CN, and if we wanted to, we could put the proton in there, the hydrogen, just to show that it's still sitting in there. But that would be your example of how we would go through and we would do a reaction like that. And it can be a number of different nucleophiles, right? It doesn't have to be sodium cyanide. We could use Grignard's. We could use alkyl lithiums any number of organometallics. So we could also do reductions for that matter. So what we say here is that epoxides, if we're looking at the epoxide, we can create a small star chart with epoxides. And we could look at what happens if we do RO minus as the nucleophile, or CN minus, or we could have RS minus, or Grignard's. Or we could have RNA. Or we can even have, let's go in the wrong direction. We can even have H minus in the form of LAH. And we can create all these different substitution patterns where that nucleophile comes in and binds to it. Let's make that an R prime. This gives essentially the same thing. And here, we would add that hydrogen. And so we look at all the different ways in which that epoxide can be opened up with nucleophiles to create different substitution patterns. Okay, what is it that all of these nucleophiles have in common? If I look at every one of these nucleophiles, this is an oxygen anion, carbon anion, sulfur anion, hydride. This is a carbon anion and a carbon anion. So what do these all have in common? They're all anions, right? Yeah. So these are all anionic nucleophiles. These are what we call basic conditions. Basic conditions meaning that there's base present, right? R O minus is base, C N minus is base, R S minus is base. All of these are basic conditions. What happens if we change that and flip it and we look at acidic conditions? So where can we go with acidic conditions? And how does that change things? With acidic conditions, now what we're doing is we're looking at taking an epoxide and looking at using HX. But the mechanism fundamentally changes here. What happens in this mechanism is the epoxide, rather than undergoing an SN2, winds up picking up the proton first. Once it picks up the proton, the oxygen is positively charged, and then X minus can come in and attack this. So this is not exactly an SN2. This is a little bit different. And most of the time, what winds up happening is this step here. This component here can look fairly SN1-like. Where it comes up and does the attack. And that means that substitution patterns can be different than we expect. So let's take an example and look at an example. Let's do an epoxide that has very different sides. And we will do PTSA, peritoluyl sulfonic acid, and isopropanol. And we want to see what's going to happen. So PTSA, just to remind you what PTSA is, it's an organic acid. It looks like sulfuric acid, but it's soluble in organic solvents. And so it's a strong acid, like sulfuric, but soluble within organic solvents. And so the first step in this mechanism is that it picks up the proton from the PTSA. Then, when this thing is protonated, now that oxygen is stressed, and the oxygen can't hold on to both of the carbons simultaneously. So it has to let go of one side more than the other. So what happens is this side over here, which is on the tertiary center versus the primary center, the tertiary center lets go to some degree. Not entirely, but considerably so. And then the alcohol can come in. And can attack that tertiary position. It's not SN2, it's SN1-like. And so it's going for the more substituted position. And then some conjugate base removes the proton. And the reaction completes. And so under acidic conditions, what we find is that the side that gets attacked is the side that is the more substituted one. Now, if you want to compare this to something and you want to say, well, what is this like? How is this? How do I understand this? Do you remember this reaction? Or I could do it, NBS and water would do the same thing. So these would give a similar sort of reaction. Do you remember what product this gives or how to determine what the product is that this gives? So this is from the alkene chapter. And in the alkene chapter, we found that this could go one of two ways. It could go either this way, or it could go this way. And the question is, which one of these is correct? And what was the mechanism that this went through? So what happened here is the oxygen polarizes the BROH. The double bond reaches out, grabs the bromide. Oxygen is kicked out as a leaving group. The bromide turns back around and makes the cyclic brominium ion. So there's our cyclic brominium ion. Then the hydroxide comes in and attacks. But it has two options. It could attack either the tertiary position or the primary position. And what we said was that the cyclic brominium can't hold both sides equally. That what winds up happening here is that the cyclic brominium, it's too big an eraser, the cyclic brominium can't hold everything simultaneously. And so what happens is that that partial positive gets split between the bromine and the carbon. And so the side that gets attacked is the side where that partial positive charge is. That these aren't governed like SN2 reactions. That this thing is going to wind up going towards this guy as being the major outcome, the major product, because of that partial positive charge. And so what we're saying is that when the epoxide gets protonated, the protonation of the epoxide creates a situation where this is identical to the cyclic brominium ions that we looked at. So this works. Like cyclic brominium ion, where I get the partial positive here. And we also said that these were very much like the cyclic chlorinium ions, that these had the same sort of reaction profile mechanism. There we go. So that they tend to react more on their tertiary centers than on the primary center. So that's our sort of aside there and how to understand how those guys work. They work like the cyclic brominium and cyclic chlorinium ions. Here, let's take a look at another example maybe and see if we can figure out what happens here. So here is an epoxide, and what I want to do is I want to react this with NH3. And I'm going to do it under acidic conditions, PTSA. So when I see this, I read acidic conditions. So if I'm reading that as acidic conditions, then I got to say, all right, well, where is this nitrogen going to go? How is this nitrogen going to attack? And what center is it going to end on? So go through and protonate it. And then figure out, once you protonate it, what the two centers are of the epoxide. So what is this right-hand side here? How would I classify this right-hand side?
It would be the less substituted side.
It would be the less substituted side. Is it primary, secondary, or tertiary? What is it?
Secondary.
Secondary, good. And the other one?
You're almost tertiary.
Tertiary. So this is secondary, and that's tertiary. So that's good. So what's going to happen then is that the ammonia is going to come in, and it's not going to go for the less substituted side, because what's going to happen is this bond over here is going to fragment, leaving the larger partial positive charge on this tertiary center, and this guy is going to attack the tertiary center. This bond is going to break and open up fully. So when that happens, it does happen from the backside. Initially, this is going to be protonated, and we'll have to deprotonate it in a minute. But you can see how that came in on that tertiary center as opposed to the secondary center. And then some base takes the proton, giving it back to the nitrogen. And we can swing that around to its final product. So acidic conditions, when we're under acidic conditions, we always put the incoming nucleophile on the more substituted position. But I have to caution here. Let me show you another example. Let's say that we want to do a synthesis. And let's say that what we want to create is something where I have maybe a benzene ring here. I'm going to do it directly attached. And I want to create this, and I want to create it from that guy. Do you see what I set up here, or what it looks like I set up? Can you see the pattern that was created from back here? Thinking about an epoxide, a tertiary and a secondary position, an attack at the tertiary position. So in one sense, it looks like what I could do is it looks like I could disconnect here and I could go back to an epoxide or actually I guess I should change these too big an eraser. I need to put this forward. I need to put that back in order to be consistent with what I was trying to do. So it looks like I could go back to this and possibly a Grignard and bring that in. And then that epoxide could go back to the alkene, right? Everything looks good. Everything looks like it's supposed to. Here's the problem, or maybe you could tell me what the problem is. What is the outcome of this reaction? If I take this and react it with the Grignard, one, phenylmagnesium bromide, and number two, dilute acid, what do I get? Where does the ring go? Does it go to the tertiary position or does it go to the secondary position? What sort of conditions am I under?
Well, there's a steric hindrance, I guess. It goes to the secondary position.
Right. Now, because this is under basic conditions. Let's change it to blue. Blue to me always implies basic. Red implies acidic for some reason. So because I'm under basic conditions, I'm going to go for that secondary position. And so the outcome is going to be that the ring is going to attach here. And I'll get that.
It's because of basic conditions, not because of steric hindrance.
Well, but basic conditions imply that the steric hindrance is working. And so under basic conditions, it's SN2. And so when I'm looking at an SN2 reaction, I go for the least sterically hindered position. I go for the secondary position. So saying basic conditions and saying steric hindrance are sort of the same thing because the reaction is being governed by sterics because it's SN2, because it's basic. So they're all sort of strung together. They're all linked together. All right, but that's not the substitution pattern I want, is it? So the substitution pattern I want says, oh, I need to try acidic conditions. So then I go, oh, okay. Well, then clearly what I needed to do was I needed to take this guy and do acidic conditions. So now I do one, this guy, and two, PTSA. But PTSA and dilute acid are the same thing, and doing them in two different steps, that doesn't work. So I got to get rid of these two steps. But if I get rid of these two steps and I throw them all in at once and they all get thrown into the reaction at once, something else happens. Do you know what else happens?
Well, the protons will just hang out with the epoxide.
Not with the epoxide.
Open up the ring.
Does the Grignard and the PTSA react together?
Yeah, the Grignard takes the proton from the PTSA, and Grignard is destroyed. And so what you get is you get no reaction with the epoxide, and you get benzene. In other words, you cannot use a basic reagent under acidic conditions. So you can't use a Grignard or an organometallic or even an oxide or a sulfide. You can't use any of the other reagents that we would use. So R minus, CN minus, RO minus, RS minus, these can't be used under acidic conditions. Meaning that while I want to do these things under acidic conditions, this idea of being able to do this reaction, being able to react at this other center over here at the tertiary center and doing it under acidic conditions, it works for only a very few nucleophiles. It doesn't work for almost any nucleophile that we would generally want to use. It works, these acidic conditions work primarily for nitrogens. For NH3, RNH2, and perhaps R2NH. And really, that's the only thing that they work for. Everything else is pretty much off the table. I'm looking to see. So the big takeaways from these. Sort of big takeaways. Is that if we want to use an epoxide, that we can come in with a nucleophile and we can open this up to give that 1-2 pattern. And so I've got 1 and 2, and that's the 1-2 pattern. If I want the oxygen in a different pattern, then I can think about a nucleophile coming in and attacking a carbonyl. and this one just being on carbon number one. And that I can do this other type of reaction, but I'm very limited in terms of the nucleophiles that I can use, that it needs to be a neutral nucleophile, not an anion. But that this reaction is limited to neutral nucleophiles. And so it's best to kind of stay away from that. These are basic conditions. These are acidic conditions. And that acidic condition is really limited to neutral nucleophiles, not any of their anionic nucleophiles. So that's the big thing there. All right, we are almost, we got one little bit here to do. We're out of this chapter. We're into the aldehydes and ketones chapter and a little bit on aldehydes and ketones before we launch into spectroscopy, which means that we'll be launching into spectroscopy, I think, on Wednesday. And we'll start a shift in the types of things that we're looking at. But we've got just a little bit left here on aldehydes and ketones and their chemical reactivity. With aldehydes and ketones, one of the things that we want to look at, I hadn't really thought yet about how I wanted to organize my ideas on this chapter, is I want to look at first the reactivity of aldehydes and ketones and understand aldehydes and ketones a little bit. I mean, we have, with aldehydes and ketones, we have the synthesis of these molecules. We have different ways that we know how to make aldehydes and ketones. We have reactions of aldehydes and ketones. And we could do a couple of different brain is freezing for a minute. I'm trying to figure out what's the best way to do. Let's do it this way. Let's do formation. So these are some just review things. Formations of aldehydes and ketones. Some of the reactions that we had that were able to make aldehydes and ketones is that if we had an alkene, that we could do ozonolysis. And we could do a reductive workup, zinc and water. We can make a ketone or an aldehyde, depending upon the symmetry of the double bond, depending upon what's there on the double bond. So if the double bond is symmetrical, and we did ozonolysis and reductive workup, then we would get two equivalents of the aldehyde as that molecule breaks apart. So we're just looking at the ozonolysis and just splitting of that molecule. We also knew that we could take alcohols such as a primary alcohol, and we could use oxidizing agents, PCC or PDC or SWERN oxidation, and we can oxidize them up to an aldehyde. And we can get it to stop at the aldehyde. The other reaction that we had was secondary alcohols. And those secondary alcohols could be oxidized by any oxidizing agent. These will oxidize up to the ketone. So we can go that route. If we wanted to, we could take carboxylic acids and we could reduce them down with lithium aluminum hydride. And then we could reoxidize them up with PCC or PDC. And we could take them back to the aldehyde. So we could follow a system where we do reduction and then oxidation. So that we didn't really think about the ability to be able to do that in the past. But that's a little bit of something that we can add in. So these are reactions, ozonolysis, that we've had where we can make aldehydes and ketones. We've had our oxidation reactions from alcohols. All of those are all possible reactions that we've gone through and done. And we have said that aldehydes and ketones, in terms of their reactivity, I've given you a reactivity scale before. That reactivity was that aldehydes were the most reactive, followed by ketones, followed by esters, carboxylic acids, and then carboxylates. This is the most reactive. And least reactive. But there's a problem in looking at this. When we look at how reactive these carbonyls are, when you look at the partial positives at each one of these, the partial positive on the ketone is actually larger than it is on the aldehyde. And what we find is that the partial positive on the aldehyde really isn't all that big as compared to the partial positive on the ketone. You can go into WebMO and you can build an aldehyde and you can build a ketone. And you can ask it for the partial charges and you can look at the partial charge on the carbonyl. And you'll see that the carbonyl carbon on a ketone has a much bigger partial positive charge than a carbonyl carbon on an aldehyde. And so the question then is, why is the aldehyde more reactive? What is it about an aldehyde that allows a nucleophile to attack it faster than a ketone? What is it that slows down the ketone? Any ideas?
The presence of the hydrogen.
It is the presence of the hydrogen, but how is the hydrogen different from a methyl?
The hydrogen can be more easily plucked from the molecule.
Look at it this way. let me draw it this way. And then in my drawing, maybe it will. Provide an idea.
Styrix.
It's Styrix. Yeah, it's really about Styrix. It's really all about Styrix. And that the methyl group being tetrahedral and having free rotation about the sigma bond, in that that guy can rotate, this group is just really large. It's big, sterically bulky group that hangs out here and blocks access to the carbonyl carbon. And the proton is just tiny. It just doesn't take up that much room. And so it's really about Styrix. So there's a reaction that we can look at that tells us how much more reactive aldehydes are than ketones. And I love this this idea that if we take and we look at this reaction, which is a hydration reaction, it takes a carbonyl and we have two R groups on the carbonyl, so we can have R and R prime, and we add water to it, and the water adds to make what's called a hydrate. And we can go through and we can look at the mechanism of how that water adds to it in order to make that hydrate. But one of the things that's fun to look at is the relative rate of different carbonyl compounds. So I want to look at the relative rates. And the relative rates, we'll use this for 1.0. So if this aldehyde is 1.0, and then we're going to measure the relative rate of how fast this reaction goes for all the rest of these compounds, this is our baseline. So what we do is we take acetaldehyde and we divide the rate of formation of these other hydrates by acetaldehyde, essentially. What we find is that this one is 2,200 times faster. Now, that's for formaldehyde. That's not really interesting. But look at this one here, which is a tertiary butyl group. Rather than a methyl, we've got a tertiary butyl group and the proton. So this is still an aldehyde, but I've got that big sterically bulky group that's there. This falls to 0.09. Okay, now this one looks like it's less bulky because all I did was replace the proton with another methyl group. This falls to 0.0018. So you see how much effect just that methyl has, replacing that methyl. If this one is going at a rate of one, if we flip this around and we say, well, how much faster is this going? 1 divided by 0.0018, what is that? 1 divided by 0.0018. That means that's 500 and almost 560 times faster that this one is reacting than this guy over here. That's a big difference just in the change of that proton to a methyl. And I like to put this one in because this one is sterically about the same as this. But what's the difference between these fluorides and what do these fluorides do to this thing? Any ideas what those fluorides are going to do?
Withdraw electrons.
They're going to withdraw electrons. So what is that going to do to the partial positive on the carbonyl?
To make it quite positive.
It's going to be really positive. What do you think that's going to do to your reaction rate? Is it going to speed it up or slow it down?
All the way to the right, so it's going to slow it down even more.
I don't take position into no, it's not about position.
Speed it up.
It's going to speed it up. It's going to speed it up. This is 22,000 times faster. So not 2,200, but 22,000. So it's a combination, actually, of sterics and electronics that, while sterics tends to govern, if we're just looking at protons and carbons, we can look at the steric issues. So all of these, I would say here, these are all about sterics. But electronic factors of making the partial positive really, really big can overwhelm the steric factors and can be more important than the steric factors. So it's just interesting to be able to see that it's never one way or the other way. There's no hard, fast, absolute rule that you can follow. Sometimes sterics is more important, sometimes electronics is more important, and it's apples to apples, oranges to oranges that we need to compare, right? So when we're comparing hydrocarbons and they are all just carbon and hydrogen, sterics is what really is playing a role in this. But when we get beyond that and we start putting really strong electron withdrawing groups into it, electronics can start to play a role and can be overwhelming. And so that's a component that is there with that. So I just wanted to give a little bit about that reactivity, because I'm going to come back and we're going to do aldehydes and ketones later again after we hit the spectroscopy stuff. But I really wanted to give you a sense just real quick about why aldehydes are so much more reactive and how much more reactive an aldehyde is than a ketone. And that the aldehydes, while I've said they are very reactive, I haven't shown you this sort of data to say this is how much more reactive they are and this is why. And so it's not just about the partial positives. The partial positive is greater here, but the sterics is also greater here. And that's the thing that really makes that much more reactive. Makes the aldehyde more reactive than the ketone. Okay. Anyway, I think this is a good spot to cut it. Let's cut it here. And let's pick up with spectroscopy. I'll give you just an idea of where we're going real quick, because I've got just a couple of minutes. I can just tell you spectroscopy, we're going to be looking at, let me kill the screen share because you don't need to see the screen share part. We're going to be looking at spectroscopy now, switching, trying to understand how do we know what these molecules look like. So far, we've been talking about these molecules, and it's been a semester and a half, and you've taken everything on faith that we've said about these molecules and understanding what they look like and why they react and how they react. How do we even know that they react in these ways? Some of that is based on what we've done in lab, where we look and we analyze and we use FTIR in order to figure out if the molecule has the functional groups that we say that it has. We also use that FTIR as a fingerprint. So we compare a known molecule to the FTIR that we obtain and we say it matches or it doesn't match. And so therefore it has the structure that it has. But we haven't shown you how to take an FTIR and work it from a complete unknown to figure out what a molecule is. And the reason is you can't. There is no program that can scan an FTIR and then backtrack and tell you what the molecule is, unless it also has a database that is connected to it of hundreds of thousands of FTIRs, and it just compares in that database until it finds a match. Otherwise, there's no principle that allows us to backtrack and tell atom connectivity. We can tell a molecule is an alcohol. We can tell it as a ketone. We can tell it has aromatic rings. We can tell all these different functional groups, but we can't tell how many functional groups it has. We also can't tell the connectivity of those functional groups. There's no way to tell how many types of carbon there are in the molecule. So FTIR is actually pretty limited. So what we're going to be doing is we're going to be going through a number of different spectroscopies. We're going to be looking at nuclear magnetic resonance, NMR. We're going to be looking at mass spec. We're going to be looking at IR. And we're going to be looking at these three different types of spectroscopy and how they are used in conjunction with each other to figure out what a complete unknown molecule is. And this is structural elucidation. So structural elucidation is all about determining the structure of a complete unknown molecule, which is what we have to do on a daily basis As chemists, we're constantly confronted with new molecules and trying to figure out what that new molecule looks like, what its shape is not just a matter of going and doing X-ray crystallography. Everybody says, oh, just do X-ray crystallography and you get the picture out and we know what it is. It doesn't work that way. In order to do X-ray crystallography, you have to make a crystal of it. And not only do you have to make a crystal, it has to be a good crystal. And then the molecule has to be big enough to be able to discern differences in the crystal structure, to be able to tell where the different elements are connected within it. So X-ray crystallography is not our go-to structural determination. It really is about these other types of spectroscopy. Mass spec, in order to find the mass of the molecule. NMR, in order to be able to tell the different types of carbon and functional groups and atom connectivity. And IR to verify the functional groups so that we know what we're dealing with even before we get into NMR. So it's using these three different pieces of information in conjunction with each other. And we need to learn how to go through, process that information, organize that information, and then how to rebuild the molecule from that. So lots of puzzling, lots of fun stuff coming up.
Do you think direct observation with AFM is not going to be anywhere replacing any of these things anytime soon?
AFM is atomic force microscopy. In AFM, what they do is they use an electrode that is made from a single molecule. Usually it's carbon monoxide, but it can be other things. So you have a tip on an instrument. Think about a needle tip. And as it comes down to a needle, now imagine the smallest needle you could possibly think of, that as that needle comes down to its tip, it has just a couple of atoms at its tip. And the very last atom or molecule that they put onto it is like a carbon monoxide. Then they lower that thing over the top of a molecule and they move it back and forth, infinitesimally small. And what it does is it vibrates as it gets close to the electrons on the molecule that it's sensing. And as it vibrates, we get a picture, an idea, a change in voltage, essentially, that is transmitting through that single molecule to tell us about how the electron density that it's observing on the surface. And so if a molecule is on a metal surface that is held very, very stably, and you can pass it over that molecule, we can get an idea of what that molecule looks like, but it works for flat molecules. It doesn't work well for three-dimensional molecules. So if you have things like benzene rings or these polymers of carbon or ring systems that are mostly flat, yeah, you can get some pretty cool AFM structures out of that. But no, it's not going to replace these other types of spectroscopy.
Okay, because 3D is hard.
3D is hard. It doesn't work for 3D because you can't scan below the first layer. Right? All you can really see is the first layer. So yeah, I don't see atomic force microscopy being able to do that. Although there is solid phase NMR, which is getting better and better. And the solid phase NMR allows us to take a solid and structurally do NMR on it and analyze it and get some interesting stuff out of it. So there are some cool things that are on the horizon. But right
now— Is it also with the crystal?
It does not have to be. It is a crystal because it's a solid, but oftentimes they will do it in a matrix in the similar sort of way that they do liquid NMR. It's just the homogeneity of the, for NMR to work, what you do is you take a sample and you put it in a very strong magnetic field. When it's in solution, as everything is mixing around and we rotate that tube, the magnetic field that we put it in can be homogenized. And it is that homogeneous magnetic field, same everywhere within the sample, that allows us to be able to get good readings out to tell what is happening in there. When the magnetic field is not homogeneous and you have pockets of strong magnetism and weaker magnetism, then you get varied information coming out, not consistent information. The whole trick with doing it solid phase is to have a consistent magnetic field. And so they have found ways to be able to take and embed material in a solid matrix and yet homogenize the magnetic field. And then that gets out key information. So it's not really a crystal like we would do X-ray crystallography. It's still embedded in a solid matrix, but it's about the homogeneity of that solid matrix and the strength of the magnetic field and the ability to homogenize the magnetic field that really makes it key, is my understanding. I may be slightly off in that, but I think that's my understanding and how that works. We won't take a look at solid phase NMR. We'll only look at the solution phase NMR, but the principles of NMR and how it works, we'll go into that and talk about that theory and show you how it works. And as interesting as it is, NMR is nothing more than radio frequencies. It's sitting there and playing music with instruments, with molecules, and listening to the molecules that as they give off radio frequencies. So as much as we call it nuclear magnetic resonance, NMR, it's only nuclear in that we're listening to the nucleus, but it's all done with radio frequencies. So there's no radiation or there's no ionizing radiation, I should say, in NMR. It's the same as when you go and you get an MRI, magnetic resonance imaging. MRI is NMR just being done on your body. They put you in a big magnet and then they shoot radio waves through you. And then they listen to the sound that comes back off the atoms that are in your body. So lots of fun stuff to talk about. But we'll get there on Wednesday. We'll pick it up. Start with some new cool stuff.
What should we be working on?
Oh, okay. So you guys just finished the test. I should put up another quiz that constitutes this last chapter. And I think that it's going to be a clean break with nuclear magnetic resonance and mass spec, and that I will not mix the two topics within the test. So the next test that we have will be just spectroscopy. So Travis, I would say the best thing to do is to go start reading the spectroscopy chapter and get a little bit of insight into that spectroscopy chapter. So you don't need to start working problems yet, but start reading that, because that's going to be helpful as we start to introduce those topics.
We're going to come back to synthesis at some point.
Yeah, after spectroscopy.
Very good.
Yeah. Okay, so a little bit of a break here. You guys finish up that test, get that test in, start reading spectroscopy, and we'll pick it up there on Monday. And then in that first lecture, then Travis, after we get through that, I'll give you work and I'll give you locations to go and do practice problems and all that stuff.
Okay, cool. Wait, we have class on Wednesday, right?
We do have class on Wednesday.
Okay, cool.
Yep.
Right on. All right, thank you.
Okay, take care, you guys.
Thank you.
You too, bye.